Yeah, this wing here is ready to go. If you want, we need to have a gauze seat on put inside there.
And then,
two doctors labor over the patient as he sleeps, his head peacefully encased in a clear plastic helmet feeding him anesthetic. The patient, an immature bald eagle, is being prepared for a long flight to the Raptor Center in Minnesota. There, he'll undergo a series of intensive tests. Dr. Jim Scott with the Arctic Animal Hospital in Anchorage.
The only way we have at the moment that we know to tell if they have anything going on inside of them still is to do hot water samples of their feces. Part of the reason for additional studies being done on this bird who's sick is that we're going to try and find some parameters to evaluate these birds, and that'll be done through the laboratory that Dr. Reddick has in his operation at the University of Minnesota, because it's imperative that we find out how to tell if a bird's able to be released. If you wash a bird up and you make him look nice and you say, well, gee, let's let him go back to the sound, you really haven't done very much as far as the bird itself is concerned.
Dr. Pat Reddick with the Raptor Center in Minnesota stands on the other side of the operating table, bandaging a wing. He plans to run a series of sophisticated blood tests on this eagle to ascertain the effects of the heavy metals and toxins in the oil it's ingested. Researchers know that heavy metals like lead can cause birds to die from a complicated internal reaction which simultaneously poisons and starves them.
Essentially, that's right. Yeah, he becomes toxic because the kidneys aren't functioning properly, and he, in a sense, starves to death because the liver is not processing food properly.
Reddick will treat the bird with chemicals designed to flush heavy metals from its system, a process that usually takes 4 to 6 weeks. But that's just the beginning. If the patient survives, it'll still be a lot longer before this eagle flies free.
These feathers, no matter how much work is done on them to remove the oil on them, will never fly again. The structure of the feather has been damaged by the oil. Fortunately, birds molt a new set of feathers every year. And
that means a year in captivity. In Anchorage, Dr. Scott is trying to organize a network of centers to care for the birds during this period. Nobody knows how many potential patients are out there. The effects of oil on eagles are difficult to spot, and because the spill occurred during the nesting season, the impact on the bald eagle population may be more drastic than first believed. A little bit of oil on an eagle egg means it'll never hatch a live and healthy bird. Dr. Pat Reddick.
Now, it's not to say it's going to drive the bald eagle as a species to the brink of extinction, but in terms of the population in the Prince William Sound area, it's going to have a major effect on that population itself. And we would like to see some work done to monitor the population on a very consistent basis over the next several years to find out just what the productivity in the sound looks like and determine, in fact, what the impact of a single random catastrophic event like this is on bald eagle populations. It's something that's never been studied before.
Hey, Lisa?
Yes.
Would you come around and just take this and hold it so it doesn't drag across anything when I...
Okay.
Just like that.
For APRN, this is Johanna Urich.
I think you're just pushing against the skin here. No,
we're not getting any pocketing going here.
I think you just have to mostly go down distally with it for right now.
Exxon held its annual meeting in a small town, Parsippany, New Jersey, which is about 30 to 40 miles just west of New York City. There were 200 to 300 demonstrators that showed up throughout the morning. They brought a lot of lively signs. They lined the driveway to the hotel with representative tombstones with the names of a lot of places that you're probably more familiar with than I am, coves and inlets and harbors in Prince William Sound that have been affected by the oil spill. And they spent a couple of hours denouncing Exxon and its management and singing songs and arguing that the management of Exxon really needs to be ousted in order for Exxon to become more environmentally responsible.
I understand that the real sort of demonstration from environmentalists came from those who were able to actually get into the meeting, specifically a request from the head of the National Wildlife Federation for a whopping trust fund for the cleanup.
Jay Hare, the president of the National Wildlife Federation, who brought up this idea of Exxon contributing $1 billion now to a trust fund to support cleanup efforts, and $1 billion in subsequent years until the whole job is done. And this is not an idea that Exxon is happy with. Apparently, in a private meeting between Hare and Rawl rejected the idea, and he did so publicly again at the shareholders' meeting today.
I understand, too, that Rawl's resignation was demanded by at least some of the activists at the meeting.
Ed Rothschild, who I guess is pretty well known in environmental circles and represents several environmental groups, was one of the first speakers to seize the microphone. And essentially, he made the argument that in government, when high government officials make very serious mistakes, they pay for it with their jobs. And he essentially called for the management of Exxon to step down, including the resignation of Rawl. And Rawl said that he would not. And there was scattered applause for Rothschild when he made the suggestion, but much more applause from the shareholders when Rawl declined to resign.
Well, what exactly is Exxon willing to do in response to all this?
It's not clear at all what Exxon is willing to do. Exxon has established a plan for cleaning up Prince William Sound. It makes the argument that it's on schedule with that plan, that plan should be finished by mid-September. It showed a 10 to 15 minute film today of its efforts, with testimony from many Exxon officials and employees and people outside of Exxon, who all were quoted as saying that the cleanup is going well, it's going ahead of schedule, and perhaps it wasn't as bad as we thought.
What about these proposals that Exxon take on at least one environmental board member? Does that seem to be going anywhere?
Well, that was a demand that was put forward by a number of pension fund managers, including the controller of the city of New York and some big pension fund managers in California last week. And it apparently has been accepted by Rawl and the rest of the board of directors, and it's possible that they will expand the number of directors of Exxon by one sometime during this year, from 14 to 15, when they find someone who they're comfortable with.
Does it look as if environmentalists will be able to keep up any of the pressure that they've been able to generate, at least through shareholder pressure?
I can't imagine that environmentalists and others won't still be able to bring a lot of public pressure against Exxon in the months to come to make good on its promises.
The otter was only lightly oiled and seemed to be feeling pretty good. So good, in fact, the veterinarian chose not to take it out of its transport case.
Yeah, go ahead, call on here.
Call on here.
And tell
them
this one can go.
This one can go.
Where is it? Okay, we can do that.
You
can make a small.
While awaiting transport to Seward, workers fed the animal ice cubes coated with a sugar solution. The otter took the cubes one by one through the bars of its cage. At first, it gobbled the ice and pressed its face against the cage for more. Then it relaxed a bit and started rolling over on its side or back to chew, occasionally daintily wiping its mouth with its paws. The vessel Ten Bears picked up the otter near Yuzinki, where it appeared sluggish in the water, but at the holding station it seemed perky enough to have a pretty good chance for survival. A critter that came in a few weeks ago wasn't so lucky. That one was so emaciated, its backbone stood out, and it couldn't move to eat. It died within hours. Kevin Ryan of the Kodiak Wildlife Refuge says otter-catching crews just try to pick up the ones that are really bad off.
And we've got some pretty firm directions on how to approach these animals. We don't want to quote, run them and try and capture more than 15 minutes and add more stress on them.
Ryan says there's two types of capture techniques now being employed.
One of them is a dip net process, where it's just a big salmon dip net. And then the other process is what they call a tangle net process. The tangle net process has been used primarily with healthy otters doing capture techniques to try and transplant them to other areas. What they're going towards, as far as I know, is the death net procedure, because if an animal is sick enough to be able to be picked up by the death net procedure, those are the ones that are in trouble, and those are the ones we need to take care of.
The number of sea otters around the island is roughly estimated at about 2,000 to 2,500. As for sea lions, the largest rookery in the state is located at Kodiak's Marmot Island, which is reportedly encircled by oil. But so far, sea lions appear to be unaffected by the spill. That may change when the sea lions soon start pupping on Marmot. After the breeding season, scientists will be inspecting rookeries throughout Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska to check the incidence of aborted and stillborn pups. Meanwhile, activity at Kodiak's temporary otter facility is bound to be on the increase. A significant number of the animals frequent the west side of the island at Uyak Bay. Because of the oil in that area, the Department of Fish and Wildlife trained two otter catcher skiff crews in Larsen Bay. Now, with the heavy influx of oil at the north end of Kodiak, there's talk of training another otter catcher crew out of Yuzinki or Port Lions. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
So the main problem we have now is one of capture. The facilities that are going to be built out on Camp Carroll on Fort Rich are facilities for holding approximately 20 birds.
Halfway through their current fiscal year, Morris Thompson says he expects that Doyon will generate a profit of somewhere between $7.5 and $8 million, another record result. Part of that will come from their successful drilling operations on the North Slope. I ask if the Exxon oil spill will have any immediate impact on those results.
Well, obviously, as an Alaskan, as a citizen of the state, you don't like to see those types of things happen. As far as it relates to drilling, we have contracts in place that run from a start time to a period through 1992 in one case, through 1990 in most cases. So we don't feel that there will be a, quote, an immediate reaction or immediate impact on Doyon drilling. What comes down the road as far as expenditures by those companies, we'll have to wait and see.
Another topic broached was mineral exploration on Doyon lands. I ask if any of the work that's been done in recent years looked as though it might warrant production anytime soon.
We still are in the exploration phase. We're pleased that we now have four companies exploring, two here, two up near Rampart and Minto, several over by Eagle. That shows interest in our lands, and we're pleased with that. Electrum Resources, Cominco, is in the discussion stages of looking at some of our property. We've got Palomar, Caithness, and Inco, all major companies exploring on Doyon land. We're hopeful, and some of them in their third exploration season starting this year. So we're hopeful that we can find something, find it in commercial quantities, so we can hopefully create some employment, get some revenue off of our land. That's the whole idea of our exploration program. But right now, today, no, we don't have anything really specifically to announce, but we're still hopeful.
One issue that the Bethel-based Chilista Corporation has raised deals with 7i, the mandated sharing of resource revenues amongst regional corporations and the proceeds that some corporations have derived from the sale of net operating losses. I ask Morris his thoughts on this.
It was not part of the 7i agreement per se. In fact, tax issues were excluded from the 7i agreement. Chilista obviously takes a position that those NOL sales should be shareable. As one of the regions that participated in NOLs, we're in a somewhat of a unique position. We, our first glance at this is that they're not shareable, but you know, we're having our people look at it a little more closely and kind of monitoring the situation. So I guess our present position is that we don't feel that they're shareable.
The Exxon Valdez oil spill has claimed its first human victim. A food preparation worker was found yesterday pinned between an elevator and a bulkhead on the Coastal Star, the command ship for the federal on-scene coordinator of spill cleanup. The worker was declared dead at the scene.
This is an immense amount of suicide in such a short period of time. We have a pretty high suicide rate in Kodiak. Normally we have a high rate, but this many so close together is really extreme.
When I saw that oil in the water, I just had this sinking feeling, here we go again, you know. It's one thing when it's over in Prince William Sound, you're really sad, but to have it hit you right in the face, that this is going to happen to me again, you know, it's pretty hard to take.
Combine oily garbage and seawater, burn it, and Joe Thornton of Greenpeace says it's a recipe for something even more toxic, dioxin. Thornton has prepared a report called Adding Insult to Injury, which details the dangers of burning or incinerating oily garbage.
Incinerators for oil spill wastes are dioxin factories. They'll not only be putting out dioxin, but also furans and dozens of other toxic chemicals, which persist in the environment, build up in the tissues of fish and human beings, and cause such sorts of damage as cancer, liver damage, nervous system damage, birth defects, damage to the reproductive system.
Thornton says that using pollution control devices doesn't guarantee the safety of the environment. All they do is shift the toxic chemicals from the air emissions into the ash. Even the most technologically sophisticated incinerators will not protect the environment from hazardous chemicals.
No matter what sort of a furnace you have, burning chlorine with oil is going to make dioxin. And there are people who will tell you that if you control the temperature to the right point, that that will prevent the formation of dioxins. And it may prevent it in the furnace, but when the gases go up the smokestack or into the pollution control device, they cool off back to the temperatures where dioxins are formed.
Exxon does plan to burn some of the 5,000 bags of oily waste workers are gathering every day. Blue Bethard, an Exxon spokesman, says they plan to comply with existing environmental regulations, and Exxon is aware of the dioxin problem.
We are going to segregate the waste, which will greatly minimize the formation of dioxins. All burning produces some trace amounts of dioxins, but we will be taking steps to minimize it.
Part of the Exxon plan is to separate its oily garbage so that the most likely to produce unacceptable quantities of dioxin will be sent to landfill sites in the lower 48. Greenpeace agrees the oil waste should be taken to the lower 48, but recommends no burning. Instead, Thornton says Exxon should keep it in retrievable storage until it can be detoxified and recycled. Some of the oily garbage is already being burned at the Alyeska incinerator in Valdez under existing permits. Alyeska spokesperson John Ratterman says it's not being monitored for dioxin. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
I don't think that we would portray to you that we're going to take every stain out of all the rocks that are out there. Nor do I want to portray to you that I think that's necessary to be environmentally clean. Now, do I think there's very much oil left due to the stains that are in the rock? And I think the answer is no. But I do think that we can get the beaches and the shorelines to the stage where they can restore themselves and the natural habitat can live there without harm.
All burning produces dioxins in certain levels, and we will not exceed the levels that are permitted by environmental regulations.
Dioxins are toxic and carcinogenic at the lowest doses ever tested, down to the parts per quadrillion level, which is infinitesimally small. There's never been a dose of it which has been found not to cause toxic effects in lab animals.
We protest and are heartsick with the death and dying seabirds, gulls, loons, mirrors, and our national symbol, the eagle. We protest and agonize over the death of the large sea mammals, seals, otters, sea lions, and perhaps whales. Two-thirds of our island is wildlife refuge, and what kind of a refuge are we providing?
The dispersant material that we were using would dislodge some additional oil, but it wasn't doing it in a way that gave us a good operational tool with that particular configuration. Our experts in that area have gone back home, and they're back in their lab, and they're testing about half a dozen additional chemicals and probably about half a dozen different processes or techniques for trying to achieve that. We're going to try and clean up all that we've got going here with this equipment. And then we've agreed with Admiral Robbins that we'll be back here next spring with him, and we'll stand on these beaches and we'll look at them, and we'll bring our experts along, and we'll look at the beaches, and if there's something else we need to do next spring, we'll be here next spring and do it.
Exxon has unveiled a new shoreline cleanup plan that increases the number of people who would mop up the oil spilled 2 months ago in Prince William Sound. Manager Otto Harrison says the plan would also put more people to work on oiled areas outside the sound, and unlike Exxon's earlier plan, would allow workers to keep going past the September 15th deadline if the weather permits. Harrison says if necessary, the workers could come back next year as well.
We're going to try and clean up all that we've got going here with this equipment. And then we've agreed with Admiral Robbins that we'll be back here next spring with him, and we'll stand on these beaches and we'll look at them, and we'll bring our experts along, and we'll look at the beaches, and if there's something else we need to do next spring, we'll be here next spring and do it.
Coast Guard Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins said the Exxon plan looks good, and Bob Flint of the State Department of Environmental Conservation said the ball may not be rolling yet, but at least it's wiggling. Take crude oil-soaked pads and add seawater, and if you burn them, the Greenpeace Foundation says you'll create toxic chemicals called dioxins. Greenpeace's Joe Thornton told a news conference yesterday that Exxon should not be permitted to burn waste from the Prince William Sound oil spill, but should ship them out for recycling. Exxon spokesperson Blue Bethard says the company plans to separate the garbage and send the most toxic to the lower 48. But all burning garbage, he says, releases dioxins, and Exxon's incinerators won't produce more of the toxic chemical than is already allowed in cities. The spill cleanup is turning out 5,000 bags of oily waste every day. Some of that is already being burned. Federal authorities boarded a vessel chartered by a film crew from the Cousteau Society yesterday in Prince William Sound. The Discovery was between Smith and Little Smith Islands, an area heavily oiled by the spill that is now off-limits because of seal and sea lion pupping season. A Coast Guard spokesperson says the crew was evidently trying to film the seals, but a member of the crew says there were no seals or sea lions to film on the oiled islands.
Low effort means fishermen have either found better things to do with their vessels or have just given up. The Fish and Game Department counted about 300 vessels on the grounds from last Monday's third Copper River opening. That's up slightly from last week's opening, but nowhere near the 400 they expected. The Miles Lake counter is showing about three times more salmon escaping the nets and heading for the spawning grounds than anticipated. Consequently, tonight's opening will go for more than 24 hours, and an announcement is expected Sunday about the following week. The low effort is all the more perplexing because fishing is likely to be scanty on the other side of Cordova in the oiled Prince William Sound. The one healthy red run in the Ashami District is off limits, and the hatchery pinks are going to have to go through oiled water. Even if Fish and Game opens significant waters in the sound, inspections will be tough, and fishermen may see few places where they dare to put their gear in the water when the openings start next month. There's some talk of letting them fish behind booms right next to the hatcheries, possibly on a share basis with just a few vessels participating and sharing their catch with the rest of the fleet. Many deckhands decided to just not bother coming north this year once they heard about the spill, and many Prince William Sound permit holders have evidently decided to forget about salmon this year and have invested their vessels in the oil spill cleanup industry, where charter rates can reach several thousand dollars a day. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
In Kodiak, they're tired of what they regard as an inadequate effort by Exxon to clean up the oil that's washing up on the shores of their fishing grounds, so some people are planning a protest march for tomorrow. Ann Barker announced the protest in a prepared statement at yesterday's daily oil spill meeting.
We protest and are heartsick with the death and dying seabirds, gulls, loons, mirrors, and our national symbol, the eagle. We protest and agonize over the death of the large sea mammals, seals, otters, sea lions, and perhaps whales. two-thirds of our island is wildlife refuge, and what kind of a refuge are we providing?
She said the Kodiak March is extended to keep Exxon in the public eye. The spill entered its third month yesterday.
Kodiak resident Bill Quacha turned the radio on last week to NPR's All Things Considered and couldn't believe what he heard. Host Noah Adams was speaking with Exxon Vice President Charles Sitter.
The figures coming from Alaska yesterday indicate that 11,000 birds, 700 sea otters have been killed, 20 bald eagles, and the numbers could be, because they can't find all the dead birds or otters, the numbers could be five times higher than that.
Well, those sound like extremely wild numbers to me. I can tell you those we know of. We know of 300 birds, roughly, and 70 otters that are known to be dead. There may be more than that, but people are climbing all over the beaches looking for them, so it's unlikely that the numbers you mentioned are even close.
Quacha was concerned about Exxon spreading misinformation nationwide. He brought the subject up at Wednesday's public meeting. Kodiak Mayor Bob Brody said the problem is not just with Exxon. He took issue with the news networks.
The media has been our biggest frustration. You know, the first week everybody came up and took pictures of Prince William Sound with oil this deep, and then 3 weeks later they're talking about Kodiak or other areas, saying one thing yet still showing the pictures from the very first, with the implication that that was the situation we had here. And it's been real frustrating to us.
Brody says hopefully the negative press Alaska is getting will be countered by the $4 million advertising campaign being waged by the Alaska Visitors Association to promote tourism. But some people are worried that kind of campaign will let Exxon off the hook, just at a time when Kodiak fishermen are trying to convince Exxon there's a serious threat to their salmon fishery. Bill Barker.
I mean, heavens, on the one hand, we have to say our fish are good, our fish are clean, and that's playing right into their hands of saying, as the Coast Guard saying, hey, it's being done all right. We're in a double bind.
Tom Watson of the Kodiak Island Convention and Visitors Bureau says trying to promote Kodiak in this atmosphere is going to be a juggling act.
The whole thing is to put it into perspective, to show them that while we've been impacted, there are still varying degrees of those resources that are totally safe and are totally fine, if indeed they still are. And quite frankly, there is a lot of erroneous information here. There's different sources with different answers, different perspectives of the same question. It's like, is the cup half full or half empty? What is going on? Nobody knows.
Kodiak Convention and Visitors Bureau Director Tom Watson. Though Kodiak residents have been critical of the media, at least some people are hoping to use the media to advantage. Lainey Welch has the story.
Ann Barker, business owner, borough assembly member, and fisherman of 18 years, made the announcement at a public meeting today.
Our Emerald Island, with hundreds of miles of coastline, is being blackened. Our livelihood and environment is being threatened. Our wildlife is being destroyed. In most areas of the Kodiak Archipelago, there is no cleanup effort, and one is not planned. In reviewing all of this, we've decided to call for a protest march. Cleanup on Friday on May 26th at 12 noon.
Barker said it's 2 months since the tanker went aground. Islanders are discouraged at the continued onslaught of oil on Kodiak's shores.
We protest and are saddened at the slowness of the cleanup. We want a total plan for our beaches. The wind and tide has put some oil within the reach of human hands. We want the best people, the best organizational structure, and the best cooperation to clean up our island.
Barker said our surrounding waters and our hard work have made Kodiak the nation's number one port. It's a community that lives by fish. Barker said Exxon's efforts have been token. She said islanders are appalled at Exxon's stock answer to questions and concerns, namely, file a claim for your losses. Barker says cleanup contracts may have eased the sting of the disaster, but it's a Band-Aid effort, one that has caused division among the community. None of this has made the oil go away or created an atmosphere dedicated to serious cleanup. Many see the march as an antidote to a sense of division in the community. Fisherman Roger Bennin says all fishermen are united in this effort. He says it's a desperation tactic.
It's a legal, nonviolent action.
Bennin says the world must be made aware of what's not being done by Exxon.
We have to march. We have to, and we have to be seen by the agencies and the media, press, etc., the people that can make a difference, that can get up the national opinions and emotions of the people in this nation and the world. Those people have got to rise up and come to our support. Right now, nobody's doing anything. It's these little puny fishermen, these little puny islanders against the might of Exxon.
Ann Barker says Exxon must show a humanitarian rather than a business attitude. Exxon must look at their moral rather than their legal obligations.
Exxon needs to demonstrate an attitude that includes an affinity for our environment, a love for our land and sea, and respect for Alaskan citizens. We are the citizens of Kodiak Island, and we will march. We protest and are embittered against Exxon for the oil spill. We will march.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
We're ahead of target right now. We're ahead of this curve, this accelerated curve. We think we have the type of people, the type of equipment, and the learning curve that will get us to that endpoint, whatever that number of miles is. And if you wanted to pin me down, whether it's 600 or 700, or I don't have a number for you. It's not 364. You know, it's not 700. You know, we probably won't know the last mile till we finish the last one. But whatever it is, we think we can get it done essentially in this summertime period. I don't think that we would portray to you that we're going to take every stain out of all the rocks that are out there. Nor do I want to portray to you that I think that's necessary to be environmentally clean.
Exxon is indulging in a fantasy. And of course, Exxon hopes that others will join them in the fantasy that by signing this form, the Admiral declared these areas, to use Exxon's phrase, environmentally clean. That is simply untrue. That is not what the Admiral did. That's certainly what we haven't done. As a matter of fact, we haven't even signed anything, and we will not sign forms that describe in subjective ways whether a beach is clean or not. We want to expedite this process, too. But neither DEC nor the Coast Guard is indulging in this highly charged language, and we are not using the term clean.
The question boils down to whether or not the city can trust Exxon to do its best to clean the beaches around Homer. Before the council got a chance to address the issue, they heard from several members of the audience. People told the council they supported the city taking some kind of control over the beach cleanup effort. They testified they didn't feel Exxon was looking out for the best interests of the city, and some type of local supervision was necessary. Marge Tillian has been working on the oil spill from day one. She told the council it was time to take some action.
I think all the agencies, including Exxon, have failed us in a major way. As a resident of this city, you're the last-ditch effort. And after that, I think it's going to be totally up to people to volunteer and take over the whole show.
Councilman Eric Ringer was the one who asked that Exxon's beach cleanup plan be put on the agenda for discussion. Ringer has been concerned that the effort being made to clean the beaches isn't good enough and that more needs to be done. Ringer said Exxon's page-and-a-half plan wasn't enough. He wanted more information and detail on the company's commitment to keeping the local beaches free of oil.
I believe this is going to be a chronic problem. At one time we thought we may get a little bit of oil here and there. It seems that we're getting oil all the time. I was down on Bishop's Beach. I just pulled down onto the turnoff, walked down there, and I was amazed to see the rock there. I had not been down there for about 4 days. And all the big rocks between where you can park your car and the sand, they all got freckles. It looks like they got measles. There is a lot of little spots of oil on there. It even smelled like it. It was calm. It was sunny. You could smell it. There's been a fair amount of material deposited on these beaches. It's going to take a hell of a lot of effort to clean it up.
Ringer suggested that a local company be put in charge of the beach cleanup effort. He said that way people who cared about cleaning up the beach would be the ones on the job. The Homer firm Neal & Company has submitted a proposal to manage the cleanup operation. The one council member who wasn't convinced of the need for city involvement was Don Ronda. Ronda warned the council that if any city money is spent, there's no guarantee it's going to be refunded by Exxon, and it will probably end up costing the taxpayers money. But Ronda's main objection, as it's been all along, is that there are too many supervisors, and that getting the city involved will just add another layer of bureaucracy and slow things down.
When you get too much supervision, they're falling all over each other and they get in the way. We don't need to have supervisors supervising the supervisors.
Ronda said the city of Homer has no right to tell Exxon what company to hire to do the beach cleanup work. He said the city can complain about the work being done and take action to see the changes are made. But when it comes to hiring a firm, Ronda said that was entirely up to Exxon, and the city had no authority in the matter. That prompted Mayor John Calhoun to jump into the fray.
Whether or not we have authority has nothing to do with whether or not we accept responsibility. Falling very short of the mark by not coming out with a statement of saying, here's what we want. And we're falling short of the mark by not monitoring and documenting the effort that's out there now to say, here is what is happening. I think we're being lulled to sleep in this thing by getting halfway measures, which is about the equivalent of being a little bit pregnant.
The mayor's comments didn't sway Councilman Ronda, who tried one last time to make his point that city involvement wasn't necessary in the beach cleanup effort.
It is not our responsibility to take care of those beaches. That is the Coast Guard's and the state's responsibility. That's why we have the DEC, that's why we have the Coast Guard, and that's why the federal government moved in on the supervision and control of this cleanup, not just in Homer, in the entire part of the state of Alaska that's polluted.
Ronda wasn't able to sway any of his colleagues, and the council ended up voting 4-1 to request that the local MAC team ask Exxon to put a local company in charge of the beach cleanup effort. I'm Joe Gallagher.
We had to hire 2 extra police officers. My budget did not allow for that. All of the overtimes come out of the city payroll, and hopefully we'll be reimbursed for that someday. But even 4 police officers at this point is not enough.
We were real close. Last weekend we were down to 1 to 2 days supply. But at this point, we do have enough capacity on the water coming, and we've obtained some other small containers that do fit on deck barges that will hold us until the larger equipment arrives.
It just absolutely upsets me that Exxon would even consider using Wrangell as their dumping ground without even letting the people know.
Senator Frank Murkowski goes to a town meeting in Cordova tonight. The senator says he wants to know what Cordovans think about oil spill legislation. The villages and towns affected by the Exxon Valdez oil spill want money up front for dealing with the impacts of the spill, but Exxon won't give it to them. The so-called oiled mayors told reporters yesterday that Exxon has their proposal for a fund they can draw on instead of drawing on their own money. The company says it needs to have a hand in deciding what expenses are proper and will make its decisions on a case-by-case basis. Kodiak Mayor Bob Brody says that's unequal treatment.
The city of Kodiak got a $500,000 purchase order authorization. Kenai Peninsula Borough got $2 million in cash in the bank. Some of the smaller villages have been told, well, if you spend something, send it to us, and we'll check it out, and we'll pay you if you can do it.
The mayors say they're hoping Exxon will reconsider their proposal, or at least begin to negotiate with them as a group. Some of the mayors are worried that unemployed cleanup workers are creating a new crime wave. VECO is setting up a central hiring office in Anchorage to try to alleviate the problem. To be hired in a local office, VECO must now have proof you're a resident. If you're not a resident of one of the oil-affected communities, hiring will be done in Anchorage. The Department of Environmental Conservation says Exxon is not going to get a permit to burn oily wastes from the Prince William Sound oil spill without public comment. The company has burned some waste at the Alyeska terminal, but most of it, 1,000 freight containers full, is floating on barges in the Gulf of Alaska waiting for a decision on what to do with it. Exxon's coordinator for cleanup activities outside Prince William Sound, Bill Dahl, says stepping up the cleanup will pile it up even faster.
They project the bag count to increase to 7,000 per day. And on this basis, if you add up the totals, we're looking at somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million bags of oil and debris.
The company has brought a floating incinerator to southeast Alaska with the thought of burning the oily waste along with wood waste somewhere offshore. But there's already some negative reaction locally to that idea. There are also plans to burn oily waste in the Whittier City incinerator. That move is waiting for completion of soil tests. Whittier City Manager David Moffitt says he wishes all the contracts were signed. He's ready to get on with it. Exxon is bringing more barges for the waste up from the lower 48.
The city of Kodiak got a $500,000 purchase order authorization. Kenai Peninsula Borough got $2 million in cash in the bank. Some of the smaller villages have been told, well, if you spend something, send it to us, and we'll check it out, and we'll pay you if you can do it.
They project the bag count to increase to 7,000 per day. And on this basis, if you add up the totals, we're looking at somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million bags of oil and debris.
The news that Wrangell was being considered as a possible site for the incineration of oily waste came as a shock to many in the town today. Wrangell's mayor, Fern Niemeyer, said neither she nor the city administration had any inkling of the possibility. Air quality engineer for the Department of Environmental Conservation, Bill McLarence, says the Sealy Corporation has discussed a couple of alternatives for burning waste from the Exxon Valdez spill, involving a silo incinerator mounted on a barge. He says the barge is now in Ketchikan. McLarence says one possibility being considered is taking the barge to Valdez to dispose of the waste on site. He says the DEC has made a policy statement that they would prefer this to barging the waste somewhere else for disposal. Another possibility, however, is that the waste could be taken to Wrangell and burned on an incinerator based here.
Their discussion was that they thought there were several advantages of trying to burn it in Wrangell. One is that they thought it might burn better if they mixed it with the wood waste. It would give a more even type of fuel than it would just this bagged oily stuff and someone like that. As far as I know, like I said, nothing has been decided for sure. That was one of several proposals. Of course, Sealy's intentions are, after this oil spill cleanup, would be to move it to Wrangell to use it for the wood waste there.
McLarence says the incinerator barge is under the final steps of construction in Ketchikan. He says he went to Ketchikan yesterday to look at it. He says Sealy has applied for a permit, but the DEC wants the corporation to make up its mind where the barge will be operating before the permit is granted. Media representative for Exxon, Joe Tucker and Valdez, confirmed that Exxon was looking at Wrangell as a possible place for basing an incinerator barge. He says the incinerator is a very sophisticated piece of equipment and will be operating offshore, but could not say how far away from the township of Wrangell that it would be working. Meanwhile, District A House Representative Robin Taylor says that it's proposed to do a test burn with the incinerator at Sealy Shipyard in Ketchikan.
It's interesting to note that the burning of garbage creates much more dioxins that are of a toxic nature. The burning of a wood stove creates more. The burning of gasolines in an automobile creates more dioxins than will be created by the burning of this oily waste product.
Toxics campaigner for Greenpeace, Joe Thornton, says there's a significant risk to the public health and the ecosystem if the waste is burned, because there's a serious risk of creating dioxins and other extremely toxic chemicals by burning wood waste or oily waste that has been soaked in seawater.
Because there's a serious risk of forming dioxins and dozens of other extremely toxic chemicals which affect the survival of fish and human beings at extremely low concentrations. They persist in the environment, they don't go away, they hang around for up to hundreds of years, and they accumulate in the tissues of living things so that small emissions into the air and into the water end up gravitating into people's flesh and the flesh of fish and large animals.
Thornton says infinitesimal doses of dioxins are known to cause cancer, birth defects, damage to the liver, reproductive systems, the nervous system, the kidneys in humans, and to affect the survival of animals for similar reasons.
The Alaska DEC has no regulations for dioxin emissions. So at this point, they're not covered, and what it's going to take is some real pressure on DEC not to burn these wastes and not to let the dioxins be formed, because there's not an easy legal foothold for them or for us to stop the incineration. It's going to have to come about by public pressure.
Thornton says he would also urge Wrangell people to call the office of Dennis Kelso, the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, and express their concerns about the incineration of oil and wood waste. The DEC's Bill McLarence says the toxic byproducts of the incineration are minimized if the incinerators are used properly. McLarence says the DEC is going to decide in the next couple of days whether to give the incinerator permission to burn. However, Dick Stokes of the DEC in southeast Alaska says there won't be any permitting for the burning without public input. He says even though they're trying to speed up the process, it still requires that public input. A call to the Seeley Corporation in Ketchikan today received the reply that there was no one around that could comment on the matter. And Wrangell's Mayor Fern Niemeyer said that neither she nor the city of management had any inkling that the incinerator was proposed for Wrangell. Mayor Niemeyer says she hopes anybody concerned should contact the DEC as soon as possible. In Wrangell, I'm Rhonda Litchwark.
Well, Exxon came back with a counter plan that it was like two ships passing in the night. We weren't close enough even to make comparisons. Essentially, Exxon provided us with a plan that would make the municipalities subcontractors to Exxon to provide oil spill cleanup. And that was nothing to do with what we had submitted to them. We wanted a plan that gave a uniformed approach, a standardized approach to billing Exxon for the costs that resulted from this oil spill. We wanted to protect even the smallest of communities. That's why when we talk about it, ordinarily there are 15 affected communities, but we're really talking now about 25 because we've included all of the small villages that have also been affected.
So Exxon essentially, for instance, won't acknowledge that the oil spill might have something to do with increased crime rates?
Well, I don't know that they would say that they don't acknowledge that, although that was not something that necessarily came up in our discussion. Exxon is saying to us that they don't trust the municipalities not to utilize this in a way that would be gouging to them. And we're saying you trust everyone from VECO to everyone else that's working for you. You expect us to trust you, and yet you won't sign a contract with us that will allow us to have upfront payment for incurred expenses.
Well, John, you know, I was talking to Bob LaResh the other day, and we just got the grand total. Bob's the guy that has to crack the whip on how the state's $37 million is going to be spent on oil spill response. And it turns out that they have suggestions from various people in the state government to spend four times that amount already. I mean, doesn't somebody have to draw the line somewhere, sometime?
Well, I'm sure. I mean, we've all had that experience. I mean, it doesn't matter how much money there is. There's always some way to spend it. But all we're asking for from the municipal standpoint is those additional costs that come to us because of the oil spill. That is actually all that's requested. It breaks down into actually 3 points. We want an upfront payment, an impact payment to each of the communities that will allow them to use that as their working capital rather than drawing down on their own budgets. We want Exxon to agree that they will pay straight time for those employees that we've had to redistribute to taking care of oil spill items, and we want them to agree that they're going to pay the costs that we incur because of the oil spill.
Well, what do you do now?
Well, we still expect Exxon to sign this agreement. We think they will go back and huddle, and hopefully they will then contact us and come back and be ready to sign. If they don't, we have a number of options. We've decided not to show that hand just yet because if we show our hand now, we may not be able to play it later. But the municipalities by no means are done with this item.
Fishermen actually wanted more for the government to buy the leases back. So did Governor Steve Cooper, but he was pleased by the committee action.
People recognize how
vulnerable Bristol Bay is to a potential oil spill. A one-year moratorium isn't a total victory, but it's certainly moving in the direction that we want.
The idea of a buyback of the leases isn't dead, however. The subcommittee asked the Interior Department to look at the matter, and California Congressman George Miller has said he'd propose buyback legislation for Sale 92. Their main opponent, however, is Alaska Congressman Don Young, who not only opposes the buyback, but was even against the moratorium. Young says further limits on domestic oil production threaten the national security. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
We put the best brains in the world on this matter and came up with it. And I think it's a good program, and I hope all governments support it.
We all buy automobiles that have got spare tires and jacks in them, even though we may drive the car its whole lifetime without ever after using them. This is the same concept. There has to be some emergency equipment on every tanker under this bill.
The spectacular west coast of France bore the brunt of the world's worst oil spill, the Amoco-Cadiz disaster. That tragedy occurred almost 11 years ago. Jean-Baptiste Henri was an assistant mayor in a community struck by the catastrophe. He says Amoco has spent a lot of money responding to the Amoco-Cadiz spill for legal fees.
11 years after the Amoco-Cadiz oil spill, Amoco has not paid 1 cent to people of Brittany.
That's one bit of information the French mayors will be sharing with their Alaskan counterparts. But the conference's purpose isn't just to warn Exxon Valdez victims about what may be in store. The main thrust is to keep such disasters from recurring and mitigating them when they do. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
Piro would have a headquarters group and 5 regional response centers. In Alaska, the owners of the Alyeska Pipeline Company are providing an improved spill response facility that could receive additional support from the Piro centers if needed.
Greenpeace has jumped into the fray, claiming the oily fish dumping could be hazardous to marine mammals. Greenpeace regional director Cindy Lowry says there's safer ways to dispose of the fish, like barging it to the lower 48 or getting a processor on Kodiak to agree to freeze it. Greenpeace is trying to get EPA to revoke the permit. If that fails, Lowry says the permit should be modified.
At the very minimum, that there should at least be a stipulation on the permit that says that any dumping that would go on would not be done in the presence of stellar sea lions or other marine mammals.
At a meeting tonight in Anchorage, Lowry and Kodiak fisherman Dave Harville will ask Exxon to reconsider the disposal plan. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
The governor is out of state, promoting Alaska tourism again. This time, it's a matter of convincing people that the state's not just one big oil spill. But selling Alaska as a tourist destination has always been a process of changing perceptions. Not long ago, people had to be shown that it isn't perpetual ice and snow up here. That's not the problem now.
People think that there's oil washing up on the shore of Mount McKinley.
Tom Dow is the president of the Alaska Visitors Association. His group is one of 2 major tourism agencies addressing those images of Alaska this year. Their approaches are very different, but they dovetail in their goal of bringing more people to the state. When the oil spilled in Prince William Sound on March 24th, the Alaska Tourism Marketing Council's advertising campaign was already pretty much in place. The council focuses on magazine ads that ask for a specific response, sending back a card for more information and a free Alaska vacation planner. The council then tracks the cards returned. Council President Bob Miller notes that their best return rate comes from Reader's Digest magazine. Miller says the council doesn't expect to change its approach much because of the oil spill. Their campaign will choose to ignore it.
There's no reason for the tourism program to perpetuate coverage of the oil spill. We're not going to do that. We're going to advertise the planner and Alaska as a destination. There are many other avenues for answering questions about the oil spill. That's not the Marketing Council's job. Our job is to market tourism.
The Council's response cards are precious to the Marketing Council and also to the Alaska Visitors Association, which got extra money from Exxon to try to do a quick fix on Alaska's image after the spill. And where better to start than with the people who had already expressed an interest in visiting Alaska? AVA President Tom Dow says they used the cards to target a direct mail campaign aimed at controlling the damage done to the industry by massive media coverage of the spill.
We accessed the list for a specific letter from the governor, which was part of our public relations campaign, and we sent out about 150,000, I think it was 156,000 letters specifically addressed to individuals saying, we know you're interested in coming to Alaska. Please don't change your plans. It's as good a time as any to come and see our state, and we're sure you'll enjoy your trip.
The rest of the AVA campaign keeps its distance from the councils. Its most costly elements are the notorious Marilyn Monroe television spots, which finish their run this week. Then the research begins, trying to find out what's been most effective. Dow says the Gallup organization has been out asking questions for the AVA.
It was 40 or 50 questions about how they felt about Alaska. Had they heard about the oil spill? Did they plan to ever visit Alaska? Have their plans changed as a result of this? And if so, how? Those kinds of questions.
People who had sent in cards to the Marketing Council got the same series of questions. Dow says results of the research should be compiled by the end of July. The very different styles and timing of Alaskans' advertising will be evaluated, and tourism marketing could change in the future as a direct result of the spill.
The vessel will be towed by two tugboats with a couple more accompanying it as standby. Its cargo of crude oil has been entirely removed from its tanks. It will, however, be carrying diesel fuel for operation of its own engines. Those will be used to make it more maneuverable within Alaska and California waters. They can also be used during rough weather. Otherwise, the 20-day odyssey will be accomplished under tow. Exxon reports the vessel's seaworthiness has been certified by Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the American Bureau of Shipping. Bob Luch of the State Department of Environmental Conservation says their people have inspected the split tanks and found them clean.
There are hundreds to thousands of fish swimming around inside the tanks that had been pierced by Bligh Reef, and he referred to them as schools of fish, and he said there was ample flora and fauna there to suggest that it was very clean.
Lute says the cleaning was done with pressure hoses and steam. No detergents or dispersants were used. Other boats will be forbidden from entering a 1,000-yard safety zone that will surround the Exxon Valdez, with the exception of a media boat being provided by Exxon. In addition, aircraft must stay 3,000 yards away unless they have received permission from the ship's master to come closer. The Exxon Valdez is scheduled to weigh anchor at 6 a.m. Friday morning. In Valdez, I'm Steve Will.
The point man calling for legal action is New Jersey Congressman Robert Torricelli, who says the Bush administration has been too easy on Exxon so far. In a letter with around 60 co-sponsors, Torricelli asked Interior Secretary Manuel Lujan to set aside discretionary power he has to assess damages and to let the courts extract full damage payments from Exxon, Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, and other liable parties. Torricelli argues that property interests give the government grounds to sue, and that the oil industry needs to learn a lesson.
My interest is not simple vengeance. It is rather providing the only genuine incentive that will ever prevent a repetition of the Valdez tragedy. If the message to international oil companies is that 11 million gallons of oil can destroy hundreds of miles of pristine shore and thousands of birds and animals and cost no more than a few months' operating profit, then we have no guarantees for the future.
Torricelli says to date, Secretary Lujan's oversight has not matched President Bush's pledges to restore oil-damaged areas. In addition, Torricelli and environmentalists charge Lujan is underestimating the value of losses and imposing those estimates on other agencies. National Wildlife Federation President Jay Hare.
We feel the Interior's rules grossly undervalue natural resources. For example, the Interior rules say that a fur seal is worth $15. How do they get it $15? That's the price and value of the pelt of a fur seal when you rip it off its body. We think that does not have any way of contributing a fair return to the public's interest of the value of fur seals to that ecosystem. A puffin, a bird, that frequents that area, its value is $7.88, as I recall. Point being that all of these are artificially constructed values way under the value of what they, as individual species and populations and communities, commit and contribute to an ecosystem like that found in Prince William Sound.
Furthermore, the congressmen and conservationists are asking that environmental assessments be done before damage payments are set and before scientists lose more time. Again, National Wildlife Federation President Jay Hare.
The number of important scientific studies that were supposed to be conducted this summer have, for some reason, totally unknown to us, been canceled, been put on hold. And our view is, what can we learn from this tragedy so that in the future we will have gone in and done the proper kinds of assessments and we will truly understand the impacts on an ecosystem like Prince William Sound?
Congressman Torricelli says there's time, albeit limited, for the Bush administration to match its words with action. He says the country is now at a crossroads.
For purposes of avoiding future environmental tragedies, the point at which we find ourselves is as important as any in the hours or days that followed the spill. That is, whether we're going to do a simple accounting of man hours and count bird carcasses, or consider the totality of the loss.
Torricelli admits the kind of legal suit he's seeking rarely goes to trial, but he argues the fact it's initiated can bring bigger damage settlements. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.